You're listening to a punk movie review right here on the Prairie Punk Press Network.
It's just a theory, but most wars by imperialist cultures, i.e. the white cultures of this world, are fought against brown-skinned people, especially the ones who sit on top of most of the oil. And 2 million people, a massive amount of people marched in London, and another 15 to 50 million, whatever the figure was, marched across the world against the Iraq war, and all he could say was, "I understand how you feel." And that was that, fuck off, more or less. But instead of Thatcher would have said, "Fuck off, I'm going to war," Blair would say, "I understand how you feel, but I'm doing the right thing." Basically, he's doing what Bush tells him to, because they're all part of this fucking secret sect of fucking Bohemian Grove fuckwits who want to control the entire planet and get control of all the resources on it. Why, I do not know.
Hi everybody, you're listening to Punk Movie Review. We are on episode 4. The movie we're doing this week is The Day the Country Died. It's a documentary based on the book The Day the Country Died, A History of Anarcho-Punk. The movie came out in 2007, and it was directed by Roy Wallace. The book was written by Ian Glasper. My name is Neckbone.
Hi, I'm Jerbear. It's been a fucking month.
Yeah, it sure as fuck has. Which we can get way more into in our other podcast.
Yeah.
Because I don't think we have a topic for next week anyway. So.
No, we have an interview, but...
Yeah, it's true.
But we can talk about all the shit that's going on, too.
Yeah, it's true. We can do both.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah. This is a movie, and we watched it.
This is a movie.
I watched the shit out of it.
I enjoyed all the music in it. That's my biggest note, is the music was phenomenal.
Oh yeah.
And honestly, like I would have been just as happy if they would have cut out just a whole bunch of the interviews and just had just the music going on for an hour and a half. Like I could have watched that. Some of the interviews were cool, but some of them were pretty redundant too.
Yeah, I thought that. So, it was a choice to play entire songs. You know, and it seemed like filler, and you know, we can talk more about that later. But you know, while I enjoyed the music and appreciated listening to an entire song, it felt like it was kind of there to stretch it out to that 90-minute mark. And I don't know that that was necessary for what this documentary was. Not to say I didn't enjoy it. I did like it, but...
Yeah, I enjoyed it too. I'll do a quick synopsis for anyone who doesn't know. So through interviews and lots of music with major players in the anarcho-punk movement of Britain... in the late 70s, early to mid 80s, The Day the Country Died explores the evolution of the genre of anarcho-punk. And that's what it is. It reminded me a lot of the Outhouse documentary. It was Talking Heads and music. Definitely a DIY project. It even said it was a DIY project in the ending credits. Because instead of saying directed by Roy Wallace, it said DIY by Roy Wallace. You could tell that Roy Wallace didn't have a whole lot of filmmaking experience. At the same time, it's probably a good companion for the book, which I would like to read. Yeah. I'm assuming you've read the book.
I am still reading the book. I have not finished it. It's a pretty good sized book. Four to 600 pages. I don't remember exactly.
Okay, yeah, it's a pretty thick book. Yeah.
You know, I like it. I've seen it before. Having seen it once before and then reading the book, it didn't quite hit as hard and as good as it did the first time I watched it. Because I kind of have already taken in a lot of this information and it's not new to me anymore, so it's not quite as interesting or fascinating. But I did enjoy like refreshing my memory on some of the interviews and stuff.
I think one thing that I like about this movie over, say, like The Outhouse, which is a very similarly made documentary, is this movie doesn't really shy away from politics. The Outhouse movie didn't really talk about the politics of the scene very much.
No, not at all.
At all. Yeah. I mean, other than just some of the bands, you just know what their politics are.
Right.
But didn't really overtly talk about it. Whereas in Britain, it was a whole different scene. The entire anarcho-punk scene was just wrapped in politics. The two were inseparable.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's in the name of the genre, you know, it's anarcho-punk. They were real anarchists. It wasn't just, you know, Sex Pistols, shock value anarchy. It was actually like Bakunin theory, you know. It was like real leftist ideology put into practice around the veneer of a music scene. And right. One of the things that definitely the first time I watched it, but you know, this time as well, the diversity of some of the bands, like Rubella Ballet, and some of the other bands, weren't just playing marching band punk rock like Crass was. But, you know, Crass is really the one that started the scene. I mean, I think in the documentary it said Crass Year Zero, the birth of DIY. And that was really where the spirit of the anarcho-punk scene came from. You know, obviously a lot of the bands were inspired by the Sex Pistols because the Sex Pistols were huge, but they were also not serious. And a lot of the anarcho bands were more serious. Some of them.
Even though I stand by the fact that I, you know, people always argue back and forth, you know, where did punk really start? I always say punk started in Michigan. That's my personal belief. So I guess you could say America, but not New York. I think Michigan. But I don't know. I really think that the way that Britain did the scene, especially in this time post Sex Pistols and post all that, you know, kind of commercialized crap, I think they kind of perfected it. I think that's one of the most vibrant and interesting punk scenes that the world has ever seen, was that 80s anarcho-punk scene. And it really set the standard, you know, for a lot of punk bands. I mean, those are the bands that the punk bands that you like listen to.
Yeah.
So if you don't know any of those bands, but you like punk bands from the 90s, all those 90s punk bands, they all listen to those bands that are in this documentary.
Yeah.
And that's where they got their inspiration.
At least politically minded punk bands. I mean,
right.
You know, obviously like the Exploited, GBH and all that shit wasn't included in this documentary because they're more street punk and Oi, which is a separate scene. And there's probably a lot of crossover. I think Conflict probably had the most crossover with the street punk and Oi bands and anarcho punk than anyone, but it was a separate scene and influenced different music. But at the same time, I think, you know, plenty of American bands in the 90s were inspired by both scenes.
The whole reason I even learned about, you know, a lot of these bands was just because of other bands I already listened to in the 90s. And, you know, and it was a lot harder to get information back then. You could just Google things, you know. Maybe later on you could ask Jeeves. but you had to, like, you know, search through the liner notes and see, like, who are they thanking, who are they mentioning in, you know, liner notes or, you know, on covers. Stage or so I mean, I wouldn't have even known about a lot of these bands because obviously we did not grow up in the UK. We didn't grow up, I mean, we were children in the 80s, but we weren't
I was listening to Motley Crue and Poison in the 80s.
Right. I had Slippery When Wet. Bon Jovi was like, that was one of my favorite albums. So, you know, I wasn't really listening to anarcho-punk or even like bubblegum punk yet. So,
One of the things I really liked, and it's difficult when you talk about punk and the more political punks is as soon as you put a label on it, it kind of deflates what it is. You know, Ian Glasper, in one of his interviews in the documentary, said, you know, just defining anarcho-punk takes meaning away from the movement. But still, it's difficult not to categorize it because, you know, they were all peers playing shows together, and it was a movement. Or, I mean, I don't know what else you would really call it. They were anarchists and they were playing punk music.
Right.
You know, but again, there's a problem with labels. And I mean, even, you know, Crass's song Punk is Dead is a criticism of that, because once you put a label on it, you can market it, you know, and
yeah,
they didn't want to be marketable, even though they were. But yeah, and I thought it was really interesting how Penny from Crass is just like, I don't care about Crass. It was just another thing that we've done. Mm-hmm. You know, we've done so many things. Crass was a small blip on the scale of what he's done with his life.
It's
a very humble way to look at something that inspired so many people, but you know, that's not all his activism was.
Right.
Also, he just loves to be naked when he's interviewed.
Yeah, it's funny because, like, you know, when I was watching this, I kept forgetting that this was shot. I mean, it was released in 2007, shot mostly around 2006.
Yes.
And you're like, you're looking at these guys, and you're like, they don't really look that old. And you're like, oh, shit, this is almost 20 years ago. It's wild because it just doesn't seem like, but then you see, like, in, you know, some of the interviews where they're sitting by their computers and you're like, oh man, that's an ancient fucking machine they have there.
Yeah. Cathode ray.
Yeah.
Computer monitor. I think it's kind of interesting that Steve Ignorant wasn't included anywhere in the documentary. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I think there was some bad blood between Steve Ignorant and other members of Crass. Like, you know, Penny doesn't need Crass to get by. And I think, you know, Steve Ignorant was definitely from a lower class and doesn't have a giant estate that he can turn into a hippie punk rock commune. So I think he needs income flow maybe more than Penny does. So
I think it's interesting because Penny also did bring up Class I think it was kind of near the end, if I remember right.
Yeah.
And because he mentions, you know, that, like, I think he said he was middle class or something like that, which means something completely different in Britain.
He said he was upper middle
and
class.
Does in the United States. Yeah, upper middle class. Like, the way they do classes in Britain, it is very different because you can, you know, if you come from a family that's been well-to-do for multiple generations and has land or an estate, you could have a job as a, you know, like, you know, low income job. Like, you could be like a music teacher at an elementary school, but you'd still be considered upper middle class, even though your income is very low because you come from that estate, from that family.
Yeah.
And you can have made, grown up in, like, you know, like East London or something and made a fortune, but you're still not considered that upper class, even though you have a ton of money because you're just, you weren't born into it.
It's generational wealth.
Yeah, it's strange. And I mean, it's not that different in the US. People are still kind of looked down on. I mean, we do judge people mostly based on how much they make.
Right.
But which is,
new money gets,
in case you don't know, a really fucked up way to judge people. But
right, yeah. I mean, even in Wichita, new money versus old money, like, there's some weird class divisions there. It's so stupid. I think the part you're talking about was when he was talking about how Crass wasn't special. You know, he was just some privileged upper middle class guy that made records. But what was really special was some kid that didn't want to learn, I think his exact phrasing was, didn't want to learn about Jesus or algebra, so they skipped school and went and bought a Crass record. That's what's special. Crass wasn't special. It's the kid who bought the records that was special.
Yeah.
And, I mean, that's a good way to look at it. I mean...
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, he recognizes that he's from a really privileged background, and he uses that the best way that he possibly could. Mm. Because you can't really help if you're just born into a certain class. Mm-hmm. It's kind of, you know, what you do with that in the same way that, you know, if you know, you have any type of privilege, no matter what that is, if you're not using that privilege to help, you know, people who are marginalized, then you're wasting it.
Yeah. Yeah. I know we've talked before about it, but, you know, other people not in Crass talked shit about the Crass uniform, which was, you know, wearing all black and being super political. And some people weren't necessarily happy being lumped into that category. Like half of Flux of Pink Indians didn't care about politics at all and were just having fun. And the other half were like super serious about the politics, and that caused some conflict with them. And that's why Flux of Pink Indians probably didn't last, because, you know, they weren't politically aligned.
It was interesting hearing how they got their name. I actually had never looked into how they got their name.
Oh, yeah.
I just never really questioned it. Just that's the name I was presented with when I first heard of them. And so I've just accepted it since 1990, whatever it was, when I first heard of them.
Yeah.
And so that was an interesting story.
Would you like to share the story? Since you,
so if memory serves, and like I said, I was, my son was jumping around and asking me for applesauce and making me watch, Mickey Mouse Mixed Up Adventure, while I was trying to finish this documentary. They said, I forget who it was. They said, somebody from Crass had become obsessed with Native Americans. Mm-hmm. And so they started saying, they said, well, we can't say, because what was their old name? What was their name before Flux of Pink Indians? I can't remember now. The Epileptics. Okay. Okay. Yeah. So yeah, before they were Flux of Pink Indians, they were The Epileptics. And they wanted to come up with a new name. And they said they couldn't call themselves Red Indians for understandable reasons. That even back then people understood why. So they said that since they're English, they're pink. So they were going to call themselves Tribe of Pink Indians, but then they said that just didn't really, they didn't like the flow of that. And I forget who it was who suggested Flux, but they just really liked the word Flux. Mm-hmm. And so they're like, all right, fuck it, we're Flux of Pink Indians. And they made a bunch of merch and showed up to a show, I think, playing with Crass.
Yeah.
And Crass made fun of them. Like, what the fuck is that? What are you called? But it's a name that stuck, and I never really understood why they were called Flux of Pink Indians, but it's a name that you don't forget.
Yeah, it's a really good punk rock band name.
It is, yeah. And I think the word flux is really what makes it.
Yeah.
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 So good call, Colin or Kevin, whichever one of you.
I think it was Colin.
Colin, okay.
I think so. Anything else really stand out to you? I even though I don't agree with Rob Miller's current political bullshit, I do kind of like the pointed jab he had, not necessarily naming Crass, but, you know, subtly poking at Crass, saying, you know, it's not about uniforms, it's no gods, no masters. Do what you want and do no harm to other people.
Yeah.
Because Crass did have a reputation for being a little enthusiastic about their political beliefs and how things should be done.
Right.
Not everybody liked that.
Yeah. And it was interesting to see Rob Miller, knowing now what I know about him, because and I forgot, I was like, oh fuck, I really like the Amoebics too, so that sucks. Like,
yeah. Well, you know, listening to Amoebics, particularly in the documentary, they're really just ripping off Motorhead. But, you know, a lot of people like them, so whatever.
Yeah, I've always liked the Amoebics. But I guess around the same time, I really liked Motorhead, too. I haven't listened to the Amoebics in a while. And then I found out that Rob Miller was friends with that Holocaust denier. So I was like, well, fuck, I guess I'm not going to be listening to them.
Yeah.
That's going back to our last, our other podcast where we talked about, can you separate art from the artist?
Yeah.
And it's tough. It's tough there to, I realize that they're a band and not,
a singular
just Rob person. Miller.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I mean, it was still, enough for his new bandmates to quit the band, you know?
Right. And what was that Holocaust denier's name? I'm trying to remember.
I don't remember.
He wanted to put it in the liner notes. He wanted to thank a friend of his named Gerard Manuhin.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah. He was going to thank him in the liner
Who was notes. Very unfortunately born in Scotland. Oh, that's depressing. who is ironically of Jewish ancestry, apparently.
Hilarious.
And is a Holocaust denier and has associated with the neo-Nazi movement in Germany. Like, I thought that he was just one of those douchebags who was just like, oh, was it really that many? But no, he's like really into it and has said like other super anti-Semitic shit and Rob even Miller's said, quote, the world owes Adolf Hitler an apology.
Jesus like, Christ. It's,
yeah. So,
fuck
that guy. And why is Rob Miller friends with that guy? If I knew somebody who said that, I would not be friends with them. And I would probably punch them.
Are they sword making buddies? Are they blacksmiths together or something?
It must be. Unfortunately, yeah, that, and it sucks, but yeah, that whole, like, you know, kind of people who are really into like medieval stuff and old like Viking. European. Anything, any Central or Northern European, like either Viking or Anglo-Saxon or
Celtic.
Any of those peoples in that area. Like sometimes there are just Nazis, just straight up Nazis that infiltrate that shit. When a lot of the people in those groups are just really just want to like make swords and talk about elves and shit for the most part.
Which is rad. Just make swords and talk about elves. You don't have to be fucking racist about it.
Right. That's cool. But yeah, I had a friend who fucking wore chainmail because he just thought it was cool, and it was.
It is cool.
So, yeah. So, like, it's cool. It's cool to be into that shit. But, you know, why on earth would you then start just saying a bunch of anti-Semitic shit or racist shit? Yeah. It just doesn't make any sense to me. I don't know. Yeah. So when Bob from Chumbawamba was talking about, it really reminded me of like our punk scene where he'd be like, people would just come to the house and you had no idea who they were.
Yeah.
And they're like, hey, we're here. We're traveling. We're here. And you just be like, hey, you and everyone with you come into my house and you can just crash here as long as you want. But then like, he also mentioned like, but then they'd be like, I see you have instant coffee. Why don't you have the Zapatista brand
of
coffee?
Like,
just like start getting really judgy immediately. And it's like, no,
you're staying here at our squat. Fucking relax.
Right. Like, not all of us can access Zapatista brand coffee. Right. I'm sorry. Sometimes you just got to grab some coffee from the fucking store and you got to take whatever they have.
Right. Yeah.
Sorry.
For sure.
Dylan's don't carry Zapatista brand coffee. But yeah, that was interesting. Cause I can just like, as he was saying that, I could picture, for some reason, I just started thinking about, like, the Lawrence scene and, like, people walking into the Flanders house and the pirate house and even the annex and just being like, hey, I see you guys support this big evil thing. Right. And it's like, well, I mean,
we're very poor. We buy what we can afford. Fuck off.
Right. We do the best we can with... Yeah, the small amount of minimum wage we make. And who was it who was talking about, was it Dick Lucas was talking about McDonald's and how he's not, he's like, I'd never be mad at a McDonald's worker.
Yeah, I think that was Dick. Yeah, for sure.
You know, but I won't eat at McDonald's because they're evil. But you know, the workers, it's not their fault. Have to basically, like, yeah, they have to do whatever they need to do to survive.
Yep. So I also think it was a really, really, really good choice to start the documentary with Dick Lucas's rant and then going straight into No, because
yeah,
that was a great introduction to the documentary. Where it went from there, you know, debatable, but that was really good.
Right. Yeah, and that was in my notes too. I wrote, starts with Dick Lucas, exclamation mark.
Yes. And he looks the same.
Yeah.
He doesn't.
He does.
He always looks that way.
Oh, yeah. There were tons of, like, you really can tell that it was made in 2006 with all the, like, Bush and Blair.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Stuff.
All the conversations about that, see, for sure.
Yeah. And it's interesting because I forget who it was. So the movie was, of course, mostly men. There were two women interviewed. Mm-hmm.
The lady from Rubella Ballet. I don't remember her name. It was Guy Voucher from Crass.
Who was it who was talking about how anytime she walks out of the house, even in this day and age, and by this day and age, she meant 2006, mm-hmm. She still has to, like, justify her appearance or is expected to justify her appearance.
That was a lady from Rubella Ballet with the, like, super colorful hair and outfit. Mm-hmm. And Rubella Ballet did that on purpose because Crass was so
black and white.
Dark. Yeah, yeah. So black and white. And they're like, we want to be fun. We want to have color. We should embrace mm-hmm. diversity. And so they made it a point to be brash and outlandish in their attire. So I appreciate mm-hmm. that. I also
think
that Flowers in the Dustbin are just delightful.
But yeah, like after she talked about that, you know, talking about, like, you know, war, women's issues, things like that. Because you look back on that time and you think, you know, we had this great hope. And I feel like she kind of alluded to this too, of like, maybe one day I won't have to justify why I look like this when I walk out of the house.
Right.
Do you think, so this was filmed in 2006. Do you think that we're any closer to that today? I feel like we're farther away from that.
I mean, I don't know what Britain's like, but mm-hmm. I know that here, where I live, mm-hmm. It's easier to look like a weirdo. Just because, like, so many of the people who would need a fainting couch for somebody with a mohawk have died. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
I mean, some mm-hmm. boomers still look shocked, and, you know, there's some silent generation yeah. still around, but for the yeah. most part, I don't think people are too shocked. Now, seeing a 70-year-old woman dressed like that could mm-hmm. turn some heads, but I don't think it would necessarily be like with anger. Mm-hmm. They'd just be like, oh, look at that red lady. But I don't know. I have a very biased point of view about that. Because
right. Now we have things like, I mean, I guess we technically had social media at the time, but it wasn't anything like it is now. So, I mean, you can be judged from thousands of miles away, whereas you really couldn't back then. That's why I feel like it's gotten worse, is because there's, I mean, anytime you open your computer, there's somebody judging you. And this is all fucking, don't get me wrong. I've not polled anyone or read any stats. This is all vibes based. So take it with a grain of salt. But I feel like there are more younger people than I would have ever expected who are really into this idea of forcing people into a conservative look and a conservative life, and, you know, this kind of tradition, quote unquote traditional in their mind, which they just mean the 50s mm-hmm. Kind of way of living. And it feels like there's a lot more young people into it than I would have ever expected. I don't know if you see that at all.
Not really. I don't know.
Okay.
I'm not around a lot of young kids, but well, I'll say, like, when I go out in my battle vest, I get compliments on it more from younger people than older people. A lot of people will say they like it because of my trans rights patch, though. That could be what that is, because I think more younger people are open to that and appreciate that stance.
I always wonder, too, because I definitely... I feel pretty safe in Chicago, being able to, you know, say whatever I want. And, you know, I mean, I just wear jeans and random t-shirts and shit now because I'm just too lazy for any kind of a more complicated look.
Right.
Like, if I can't get ready in about 10 seconds, then I'm just like, whatever. But that's just my own laziness. I appreciate other people who put a little more effort into it. But... I can walk out of my house wearing just about anything and I'll be fine. But, you know, when I lived in rural Washington State, I could feel that maybe even more than where you live in Kansas. You know, if you stray from what people consider normal, then they're going to let you know about it. And they're going to let you know that you're not welcome.
When my leg tattoos show, sometimes I get looks because I have a iron front tattoo on my thigh. It's pretty big and noticeable, and occasionally I'll get some weird looks for that because either people don't know what it is, or they do know what it is and they don't like it. Whenever we try to go to the state fair every year just because my family enjoys it, and
you get to spend all the time in Hutch, why not?
I purposely wear like I wear my anarcho-communist chucker hat. I wear my trans rights shirt and display my anti-fascist tattoos purposely because without fail, every time we go there, I see a fucking white supremacist.
Of course.
Like proud tattoos, like... Like, not quite as brazen as having a swastika tattoo showing, but more subtle. Like, you know, you've got, I've seen some hammer skins there. You know, you see the Celtic cross, shit like that, which is, you know, subtle enough that not everybody's going to notice. But if you know, you know. And so you see a lot of those there, so I make it a point to show mine off.
I mean, there's even times, even in, you know, this wonderful, wonderful city of Chicago, where, I'll spy someone on the train or just out in public that has, you know, what I'm pretty sure is a white supremacist tattoo or is wearing a t-shirt that's, you know, that I'm just like, okay, so there's some dog whistles on that shirt. And you just think, like, God, even in fucking Chicago, you get that shit. They're just everywhere.
Yeah, there's a guy at our local swimming pool that I've seen twice, and he has the Pitbull tattoo. That is, I think it might be Aryan Nation. I'm not sure, but it's
oh, really?
Yeah, it's a clearly a white supremacist pit bull.
I'm really surprised that they would use a pit bull as their symbol.
Nah.
Because a pit bull is famously a very mixed dog.
Yeah, well.
There is no breed called pit bull. Pit bull is a mixture of a bunch of different dogs.
But they're really tough.
So anyone who says they have a purebred pit bull doesn't understand dogs because there's no such thing.
Anyway, that's one of them. And he's also got the Totenkopf tattoo on his leg, which is the skull and crossbone that the Nazis used. So see him at the pool, and you know, every time I want to say something, but you know, when you've got your kids there, it's not the time to get into a fist fight at the public pool.
Also, I'm personally offended as a now former pit bull owner. that they would use the pit bull as a symbol. Fuck them. Pit bulls are awesome. Yeah. Oh. They're super mixed dogs who are awesome and are super just happy and cuddly. And pit bulls are awesome. So fuck them. Fuck them for trying to corrupt that awesome dog. We've gotten way off track. But you know what? Just like what we say in our other podcast, we reserve the right to veer off topic whenever we want. Oh, I do think it's interesting. Sean from Rugger Bugger, I think he's the one who said it's interesting.
That's a good name. I've never listened to them, but that's a good name.
That is a great fucking band name. But yeah, I think he's the one who said it was just as important to be political as it was to be musical.
Yeah.
Well,
to some people.
Yeah. Well, and that's the interesting thing, because I would have, in my early punk days, I definitely would have, I was pretty apolitical when I was coming up as a punk rocker, but I don't know. It's, you know, I've definitely had an obvious shift, but I think it is impossible to keep the politics out of it. You can't subvert anything if you're willing to maintain or, you know, protect the status quo. It just doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
So you can't really remain apolitical, and you sure as shit can't be right wing.
Yeah. And like, I mean,
if you're not trying to make a positive impact, then
if you want to be, if you want to remain DIY and keep that ethical stance, it's hard to not be political, because that's political in itself. If you don't want the influence of corporate ownership on your music, that is a political statement. That is overtly political.
Yeah.
And that leads to other typically left-wing values, because I don't know how many people get into economic theory, but fascism and conservatism is all about corporate power. That is where they want the power to lie. They don't want government to have the power. They don't want regulations. They want free market capitalism, which at the end of the day is corporate power over everything.
Yeah.
Despite what they think.
It's kind of led me to believe that, you know, even if you're trying to be apolitical, and there's a bunch of apolitical, you know, bands I listen to, like I've said before, I still like the Vandals. I still like the Misfits. I still like the Ramones. I enjoy, under the right circumstances, which is usually a nice summer day or something like that, where I just want something fun to listen to, I'm okay with the punk flavored bubblegum rock. Mm-hmm. Like, it's okay, but I am leaning more and more to, they're not really punk bands. They're punk flavored bands. Mm-hmm. They're punk flavored rock bands.
Yeah, it's power pop.
Right. And that's fine. And if you like it, that's fine. I like it. Yeah. But it's not really, they're not really punk bands, because they're not really subverting anything. But then again, I'm not the gatekeeper of what a punk band is. So once again, take it with a grain of salt. You know, if you completely disagree with me, that's cool. To anyone listening to this, thanks for you know, if you're still listening, that's awesome. Man, we sure veered off topic on this one. But we are going to get into positives and negatives now. Do you want to start with what any positives you have?
I already mentioned the opening. That was, you know, probably one of my favorite things about it was that opening with Dick Lucas and his rant before going right into No as the opening credits. I really liked all the flyer art and pictures of the bands, even though a lot of the times it was incongruous with what they were talking about. Like, they would show flyers and pictures of bands while they were playing music from a different band, which, I mean, it's fine, but it struck me a little odd. just all the music. I really, really enjoyed the music.
That's my number one positive. I put, you know, great music.
Yeah.
Just fantastic, top to bottom. There wasn't any music in there I didn't like. A lot of it was a walk down memory lane for some stuff that I haven't heard in a very long time.
Yeah. I might need Johnny to fill my gap on who sings that Royal Funerals song. I don't remember who it was. I can't remember. It might be Crass, but I don't think it is. So,
Johnny, do you remember the timestamp?
Listening to this, tell me who that is. No, I don't. Off the top of my head,
okay.
I didn't write it down, and I looked it up and tried to find it. I couldn't find it. But Royal Funerals,
right.
Royal Funerals.
All right, Johnny, you've got your homework cut out for you.
Help us out, Johnny.
Yeah.
Other positives for you?
I know that you mentioned that they played entire songs and that it did kind of seem like filler, but I still liked it.
Yeah. I mean, I did too. I said that was one of my positives, but.
Yeah. And so I just like, you know, because part of this I was, you know, watching while I was like, you know, instead of having to hear Mickey Mouse Mixed Up Adventure, which does have great fucking music.
Yeah.
Actually, I think it's Mickey Mouse Fun House is the one that has the good music.
Yeah, it does.
They've got like this like funk soundtrack that's actually pretty good, but you know, it's still just the same song over and over and over again. So it gets pretty old after a while, but you know, tonight I got to listen to
Tube Disaster
music from this documentary, you know, on my headphones while my son was screaming for applesauce. Mm-hmm. So that was pretty cool.
I thought it was just real quick. Speaking of Tube Disaster, I thought it was really funny how, they got into a little tiff over if it was Tube Disaster or Tube Disasters. it's Tube Disaster, for the record.
Yeah.
And it really irritated one of them.
Yes. that's a band that's did everything DIY. They don't even remember the actual names of their songs.
So,
there's nothing more punk than that, is to get the song that you made wrong. What negatives do you have?
I fucking hated the green and purple reversed images.
Yep. Oh, it was same.
An eyesore.
I thought my file was corrupted.
Yeah.
Or something.
I fucking hated it.
Yeah.
I don't know why.
Yeah.
That happened. It was a bit long. You know, and when a song was playing, it would have been nice to I mean, I knew who most of them were, but just say, you know. What the song is and who's playing it, maybe.
Oh yeah, yeah. I put that in my notes too. Like, they're really bad with, you know, a nice lower thirds would have been nice.
Yeah,
when a song starts playing, and the lower thirds were kind of, they're in there kind of sporadically. Sometimes they're really good about it, and then sometimes it just wouldn't come on, and I'd be like, wait, who is that again?
Yeah,
fuck. Because even if I know the band, I don't necessarily know all of them by sight.
Right. Yeah.
And then also, like, I would have liked to have seen, and I don't know if the book has a narrative, but I would have liked to have seen this be, like, a narrative. Like, you know, something, you know, chronological and narrative. And I know it's tough, because this is, like, an anarcho-DIY scene, but it started somewhere and went chronologically. And there's a story. There is a story there. Mm-hmm. And it would take somebody who honestly has probably more experience with documentary filmmaking to pull that actual story out.
Well, if it's following the format of the book, there's not. The book is broken up in chapters by bands. So each chapter is a different band. So it's not really, and then it's segregated by location. So it starts with London, goes through the London bands. That's a section. Each band has their own chapter, and then the next section is a different location in the UK. So it's not really tied together that way. But you know, everybody, so far what I've read, you know, everyone points to the origins of the Sex Pistols and then Crass.
So Oh, and also, I guess this is not really for me a negative, but I guess for more of a general audience, it definitely was made for an incredibly niche audience.
Oh, for sure.
You know, yeah. Like the outhouse documentary.
This is
like
not
if,
for
if you don't care about right
everyday people. It's only for people that care about anarcho-punk or are interested right. in punk rock. Like, this is not mm-hmm. for Joe Schmo walking down the street. I mean,
right.
maybe they would be interested in it, but it's, but probably not. I think you all,
yeah.
you, and that is a drawback, is you have to already have some interest in the topic to find it interesting, because it doesn't, it assumes that you already know about anarcho-punk.
I guess I do like, and I wish they would have covered it more. This, I forget who mentioned it. I know it was mentioned at some point in the documentary, but I would have liked to have had them. I guess this would go in my how would I make it better?
We could
so, yeah, there's the
that.
Narrative. I would like a little bit more of a narrative. And honestly, I want to know geographically where these bands and these scenes were, because I know not all of them are from London. And I know people assume when they hear about punk in Britain, they assume every single band and everything's happening in London, but the UK is a relatively large country, maybe not by American standards, but I mean, there's a pretty wide diversity of cultures
sure.
and places around, not just England, but there's England, Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland, Ireland. You know, and there were definitely, you could tell by the accents that there were people who weren't from London.
Right.
And I would have liked to have known more about that and then kind of mention, you know, hey, we're from, you know, fucking Scunthorpe, or we're from fucking, you know, Cambridge, or, you know, just fucking, you know, Reading, mm-hmm. whatever, you know, we're from Glasgow, Scotland, right? Like just fucking like, just be like, hey, guess what? We're not from London. The UK is not just London. And
yeah.
the scene was all over the place, and I would have liked to have seen that covered more.
And that's, you know, like I said, the book does that, and it would have been nice for the mm-hmm. movie to do that as well. For me, mm-hmm. how I would make it better, I don't know how you do a documentary like this without having talking heads, but for fuck's sake,
yeah,
it's such a dry, tired format, you know.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
I don't know what to say. I'm kind of tired of just seeing fucking talking heads all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I know it's the format for documentaries, because how else do you show an interview? But,
right.
I don't know. I just get tired of it, but you know, yeah. it's not a deal breaker. I still enjoyed the film. Mm-hmm. It was incredibly DIY, you know.
Oh yeah.
Some better production would have been nice. Better sound, a better camera. Yeah. But, you know,
right.
He's making this movie on his own. And, I mean, he said, you know, this is a project of love, you know, don't mm-hmm. it. And, you know, he basically just did it for fans and people
right.
that liked Anarcho. So, you know, that's mm-hmm. that's how I would make it better, not saying that he did anything wrong. You know, it's incredibly DIY, right. you know, but that would,
yeah.
better production value would have made a better movie.
Right. And it was 2006. So the camera that he was using, I mean, today we could get better footage with our fucking phone.
Right.
But that was not a thing at that time.
Yeah.
Like, so he probably just had some shitty fucking, you know,
cheap digital camera, like, is what it looked like.
Cheap. Yeah.
And that's
camera
fine.
He got from like a pawn yeah. shop or, you know, electronics store had the cheapest one.
I think it would have been rad on like a Super 8 or something.
That takes a lot more equipment to do that.
Yeah, I know.
Than he is in a camcorder. Yeah. So I'm assuming he probably just, yeah, recorded it all on like High 8 fucking, you know, you'd buy those tapes at mm-hmm. Walmart. I guess they don't have Walmart there, but Asda in Britain.
Oh, is that their Walmart?
Essentially just their Walmart. Nice. It was enjoyable to watch, but yeah, I agree. Too many talking heads, and maybe I'm just sick of it, dude, because The Outhouse was the same format. Mm-hmm. And I'm just kind of like, okay, well, and I know this came out before The Outhouse and is about a completely different subject matter, but it still just presents the same way.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and you know, I would say that maybe for me it's an issue with rewatchability, because the mm-hmm. first time I watched it, I had a much higher opinion of it. I still think it's good. It just didn't hit the same as it did the first time. So I think something right. like this will probably have diminishing returns. For people who have already seen it. There's not right. a lot of subtleties to catch. You know, it's a talking head documentary. There's not a lot of mystery there. There's not a lot of subtlety. It's just kind of, it is what it is, you know. And the first watch, I really loved it. And this time I was like, yep, that's the documentary I watched.
I am assuming you did too. I watched this documentary on YouTube.
Yes.
I think that is the only place you can find it if you live in the United States.
Yeah, you can order the DVD from him, I think, or you could at one point.
The documentary, it almost feels like the documentary is an hour and a half teaser for the book.
That's definitely how it feels. Once I got the book, I was like, shit. It dives so much further into it. I mean, you've got so much.
Right.
You've got dedicated chapters to a particular band. So, you know, like the Crash chapter is quite long. There's some chapters that are two pages from bands that I don't even remember.
Right.
He covers a lot of bands. There's a lot of fucking bands that he covers in the book.
But yeah, anyone who wants to watch it, it's on YouTube in its entirety. It's about an hour and a half, which it is, I'll admit, even that feels a bit long.
Yeah, it's probably...
there's a lot of filler.
30 minutes too long, probably. 30 to 45 minutes too long, in my
opinion. But if you like British anarcho-punk from the 80s, then... you'll probably like it.
Yeah,
there's
a lot to like.
Definitely worth a watch. And I will personally be buying Ian Glasper's book, probably on paperback, because I just want the actual physical copy.
Nice.
But yeah, if you are so inclined, then if you want to know more, if you like this hour and a half teaser trailer of the anarcho-punk scene, then. Yeah, buy the book and read it. So I guess it comes now we're up to rating.
Yes.
So for anyone who doesn't know, we have two rating scales. We rate a movie on how punk it is. We have three levels for that. So a movie is either poser, punk'em or rocker, or upper crust. And upper crust is obviously the highest. And then we also have a how good is it scale, which changes with every episode. So I think this time we should do, I don't know how many, but we should do badly Xeroxed album covers.
Okay.
Yeah.
Black and white.
Black and white
badly stenciled, Xeroxed
album covers.
Black and white stenciled album covers.
Yeah, there you go. But how many?
Seven.
You want to do seven?
Yeah.
Seven?
Mm-hmm.
Why seven?
7 inches.
Oh, yay. There you go. Okay. All right. So 7 is the highest. And of course, 0 would be the lowest for anyone who doesn't know how numbers work.
So on the punk rock scale, this is clearly upper crust.
I was going to be shocked if you gave it anything other than upper crust. Yeah. And I agree. I am also giving it an upper crust. Yeah.
This movie's punk as fuck.
How many badly stenciled album covers would you give it out of 7?
I am going to, on my second, this is influenced by my second watch, so I'm going to say 4.
Mm-hmm.
4 badly stenciled
album
covers.
Yeah. I'm going to give it 5 badly stenciled album covers, because this is the first time I've ever seen it. So
you have a higher opinion of it.
I do. Yeah. Right.
Fair enough.
For anyone who doesn't know, our episodes usually come in at about an hour to an hour and 15 for both of our podcasts, which means that we record for 2+ hours and edit most of that, or edit like half of that away.
True.
So this time we've only been recording for an hour and 15, and we're pretty much
done. Not much else to say. This is not necessarily
gonna be a shorter one.
A bad reflection on the movie. Just there's not a whole lot to say about it. It is October now, officially, and I think that our next movie review will be Return of the Living Dead, which is a punk rock classic from the 80s. You got punk rockers, you got zombies, you got green fog.
Yeah.
What more could you want?
I'm excited to watch Return of the Living Dead. The last time I watched Return of the Living Dead was at the Rainbow Dungeon of Rock. They had movie nights occasionally. Mm-hmm. And I sat there and drank and brought my sleeping bag and ended up falling asleep on their floor watching the Return of the Living Dead. So that was a great experience many years ago. Mm-hmm. I've not seen it since then.
Nice.
Yeah. So yeah, anyone who doesn't know, Return of the Living Dead was a 1985 comedy horror directed by Dan O'Bannon. And of course, as usual, we'll play the trailer at the end of this so that you can hear but not see the movie. But yeah, I'm looking forward to doing that one. I think we'll have more to discuss. We always have more to discuss when it's a
narrative.
When it's an actual narrative film.
Well, I mean, you have the creative and story aspect to really dive into, whereas some documentaries are just talking heads, really, and show footage and stuff. So, you know, you kind of get what you get.
But yeah, so for this movie, I have no idea what the budget was for The Day the Country Died. I don't think that information is listed anywhere.
However much the camera cost.
It's pretty slim pickings on IMDb. So, everybody, check out our website, www.prairiepunkpress.com. All the information that you need for this podcast, Punk Movie Review, and our other podcast, A Prairie Punk House Companion, can be found on that website, as well as all of our socials and our Patreon, if you want to become a patron, like Mr. Power, who is the bee's knees. Or if you want to donate to our tip jar, our coffee page, you are more than welcome to do that as well if you are feeling noncommittal. Do you have anything?
No, I'm going to, my ankle's real fucked up, so I'm just going to hobble up to bed.
Okay.
I don't know what happened, but it hurts. Ow.
Yeah. I will also go up to bed, but I will not hobble. I'll probably just walk.
Poser.
Normally.
Fucking poser.
Yeah. I could shuffle or something.
Yeah, do that.
Until I get to the stairs, and then I actually do have to lift my feet.
You should scoot up the stairs on your butt.
I could. Maybe I will. I could do that. I'm not in any hurry because this didn't take very long to record.
True. It shouldn't take very long to upload either.
Yeah.
Dang, it's not even 11 yet.
I've got time.
Yeah. All right. Peace out, everybody.
All right. Thanks for listening, everybody. All right. Bye.
They only come out at night. They're mean, rude, and dead. Not them. Them.
There's 100 of those things out there.
How many did you say?
100.
The dead are refusing to remain buried.
What are we going to do?
What are we going to do?
We're going to call the boss.
They've come back to life. They're hungry. And they're not vegetarians.
The graveyard out there is full of people coming out of the ground.
We have a little problem.
What the hell is going on there?
Rabid weasels.
What?
More brains.
Do you want a party? It's party time. We got a party. It's party time. Do you want a party?
They're back from the grave and ready to party.
It's party time!
The Return of the Living Dead.
We got a party.